Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Matthew Bunsen. Matthew Bunsen is a senior fellow of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, as well as the general editor of Our Sunday Visitor's Catholic Almanac and the editor of The Catholic Answer. Matthew and Margaret Bunsen are the authors of John Paul II's Book of Saints. The Bunsens, respected for their meticulous work on a variety of reference resources, have researched and added to their earlier work on this subject in order to bring a complete volume covering the entire span of John Paul II's papacy. Their works are also included in Our Sunday Visitor's Encyclopedia of Saints. We're going inside the pages of John Paul II's Book of Saints, published by Our Sunday Visitor. Welcome back, Matthew.
Good morning. It's great to be with you, as always.
It is a tremendous blessing for all of us in the church to have the wonderful communion of saints as that great cloud of witnesses cheering us on, isn't it?
It is, and it's something that I think Catholics over the centuries have appreciated probably more than we do today. That's sort of true about all sorts of things. But we live in an age, I think, where so many people in the middle of this vast ocean of cities, to sort of torture a metaphor, feel alone. They feel isolated, and we're sort of non-socialized. Even at our fingertips, we have all of this social media. We have Facebook and MySpace and Twitter. And yet, so many people today feel alone. They feel isolated, cut off from other people. The saints are, in a marvelous way, the perfect antidote to that antisocial atmosphere today, the non-socialized world that we live in, that they remind us that we really are together, that all of us are in this together. But more than that, that we're in this together towards something much more important than what we see around us, eternal life, eternal happiness, finding the true good.
Pope John Paul II really encouraged us from the great teachings of Vatican II that we are called to be saints. We are all saints in the making. And he really brought forward during his pontificate a vast array of those people like us who did extraordinary things through God's grace.
He did. I always say that there are two very important things to remember about Pope John Paul II's effort regarding the saints during his marvelous pontificate of 25 plus years. The first is that as he traveled the globe, he always made it a point to conduct those beatifications and those canonizations that were ready for the completion of that long process, the cause of canonization, wherever he went in the world. So we have then this marvelous variety of saints, of men and women, in all of these different countries that he visited. So we think, for example, of the canonizations in Africa, in Asia, across Europe. All of these things had a very clear purpose in his mind, and that was to tell people, to remind people that holiness is universal, that holiness, that saints aren't limited to a geographic location, Europe, or a certain type of lifestyle, or a certain apostolate, in this case the religious life. In other words, saints don't have to be monks and nuns and priests and a monastery sometime during the Middle Ages. Saints are everywhere, because everyone who's born is called to be one. That was one of the great points that St. Francis de Sales always made, that every one of us is called to the heights of the spiritual life, to the heights of holiness. And it's not limited to where you are or your state of life or whatever your particular circumstances are. Those can certainly challenge and make more difficult the path to holiness, but how greater, how much more remarkable is that path if you actually achieve it? The other point that John Paul was trying to make is that saints aren't simply of the past, that we don't look at saints as just these medieval people of martyrs in the early church of hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Saints are all around us today, and saints are meaningful to us today because it is a modern reality as much as it is an ancient or a medieval one.
What are some of the standouts that really jump to the forefront of your mind?
Well, one of the immediate saints that I think of, if we're looking at saints for our time, is of course Padre Pio. If we remember that with John Paul II, he was a witness to the cause of Padre Pio, that when the cause itself was proceeding, you had one of the witnesses who was asked to testify on behalf or to give his own testimony of knowing this person was, in fact, a sitting pope. Now, some would say that gave a bit of a lift to any cause, in much the same way that John Paul II was a witness to the cause for beatification of Mother Teresa. Mm-hmm. Those would certainly be two. The one thing with John Paul II, though, is it's just the sheer dazzling number of the people that he canonized, that the people that he beatified. I believe that the number is almost, 1,400 saints. We're talking about 338 saints, 1,478 blesseds. Mm. That itself becomes a body of teaching in the same way that we think of John Paul II as one of the founders of the theology of the body. This is a kind of theology of sanctity. And if you scroll through the list of just a few of the people that he canonized or beatified, we think of St. Maximilian Kolbe, who died in 1941, a martyr of the Nazi atrocities. If we think of the 18th century and 19th century Magdalene of Canossa, a magnificent nun. If we think of the medieval nun from the 13th century, Agnes of Bohemia, we're sort of moving back and forth through history from these early medieval saints all the way to Maximilian Kolbe, to Edith Stein, of course, in 1998. She died in 1942, another a victim of Nazi atrocities. So we're seeing exactly the point that I was trying to make, that sanctity is not limited by any particular era, and it's not limited by any particular place. So just scrolling through that list that you can find on the internet, or a bit of shameless self-promotion, one of the books that I did on the John Paul II Book of Saints, you really see the diversity of the Church, but also the universality of the Church.
Yes, we're talking with Dr. Matthew Bunsen about his book, John Paul II's Book of Saints. To become a saint today, just the very technical aspects of it all, and I hate to bring it down to that level, but
yeah,
for the Church to really grasp the gift of this person's life, what needs to occur first and foremost? I mean, we might as well just go through the, you know, what's process one, process two?
Mm-hmm. No, I think you raise a very valid and important point. The complaint was often made about John Paul II, that he was making so many saints left and right that a few people lamented or complained that the Vatican was becoming, quote, a saint factory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that type of griping actually betrays, I think, an ignorance of the process of canonization in the Church. And that process that has developed over the centuries, I think, is even more important today. A, because if you look at the interest that people have in saints, it's as great today as it ever was. We don't necessarily have the kind of devotions, public devotions that we do to the saints, but you still have in culture a deep interest, a deep fascination with holiness. I suspect in part because society tends to downplay it. Mm-hmm. So much, that they mock it so much, that sanctity has become a kind of cool counterculture.
Mm.
The other is that there is this hunger in people for holiness because it of course it's there. You do long for the good. You do long for that communion with God in your life. God is calling you. Now, I say all of that because in a world that's pretty cynical today, the church can point to a process of canonization that is legal, that is theological, that is also scientific. All of those different elements come together in the modern process of canonization. And it is deliberately complicated, and it is deliberately scientific, it is deliberately legal, and it is deliberately theological. It all begins, of course, on the local level with the life of the person in question, obviously. But that's sometimes forgotten, that you can't have a cause of canonization without a candidate for holiness. And you don't really have a candidate for holiness without a kind of recognition on a local level that the person who has died maybe in the last few years or even as much as 100 years ago, that the legacy of their faith, the legacy of their lives, of that life as they led it, so changed the world in which they lived, so touched so many lives, that not only have they not been forgotten, but that their contemporaries and every generation that's followed has looked to them as a role model and has spoken of them in writing, in oral traditions, in just that legacy of faith as someone who is a profoundly holy individual. That is where it all starts. And that's why it's so difficult to sort of fake a cause for canonization if it's an authentic one and by the time that it's approved.
John Paul II, John Paul the Great for many of us in our hearts, his death, if chronicled in this book, how would you subtitle it?
Oh boy, that's a very good question. I would say that we go back to the two mottos that are most associated with his pontificate. The first was his episcopal motto, and the one that he kept with him for his entire life as a bishop, all the way to when he was pope, and that is totus tuus, the idea of all things for you. It has that rich Marian dimension. It has the idea of giving everything of yourself. It demonstrates his respect, of course, for St. Louis de Montfort and his Marian writings. But it also demonstrates, I think, this willingness, as I was saying, to give completely of yourself. It's the, to go back to that theme, it is the recognition that, not that you're small, but that you belong to something so much bigger than yourself. And that magnificent traditional Christian understanding that we find in St. Paul, that in losing yourself, you find yourself. In surrendering yourself, you find real freedom. So that's the one. The other, though, is the motto that the phrase that he used right at the very start of his pontificate when he said, "Be not afraid." It's this, not just courage, but a serenity of trust. Now, we can talk, of course, about sort of the theology of surrender that was developed somewhat controversially at the time by some of the great French spiritual writers, such as Pierre de Caussade. But for Jean Paul II, the surrender that we find in Totus Tuus was manifested, expressed in this idea of be not afraid, that if you are giving everything of yourself, you don't have to be afraid. You have no fear of what will follow because you have that trust, this willingness to put your life in someone else's hands, to let God do the driving, so to speak, to pick up a theme that I've used a few times in some speeches, to give God the trust to do with you what he deems best. And those two, I think, come together, totus tuus and be not afraid, if I had to sort of encapsulate John Paul II's own roadmap for holiness. Those would be the two.
The book is filled with so many stories, so many names, just a great, just a sky full of stars. It's hard to say that one shines brighter than any other, but there are those that are just like a northern star, point us in a particular direction. And of course, I'm thinking of Saint Faustina. Mm-hmm. The selection by John Paul for her to be one of the first, if not the first, beatification of the new millennium.
Yeah, and the thing about that that I find remarkable is her emphasis on divine mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And it tied so beautifully, I thought, into John Paul II's call for atonement, call for renewal, but rooting all of that into our trust, into our need to ask for the divine mercy to guide us. And it's a recognition that, to borrow the phrase from St. Gregory the Great, that the Church is always reforming, that the Church is always in need of renewal. And it anticipates, I think, set the table in a way for the pretty severe years that have followed as a result of things like the sex abuse crisis,
mm-hmm.
that as we work toward atonement, as we work for renewal, we must call upon God's mercy, the divine mercy that is itself rooted in love. And I think Faustina is a great role model for that. As a Polish nun, as a visionary, as a mystic, but as somebody who understood the power of that divine mercy.
You know, I mentioned a sky filled with stars, and of course, you know, you have those that come, like St. Faustina, like Padre Pio, that shine very brightly for many of us. But the fact that they still have that glimmer, even the smallest one, there's a significance to it. I mean, what are some of those that, in this, as you were doing the research for John Paul II's Book of Saints, that touched your heart in a surprising way?
Oh, boy. It's another really great question. I think, like you, I tend to focus a bit on some of these martyrs, some of those, the stories of the 103 Korean martyrs, for example,
mm-hmm.
Of the martyrs of Japan, of the martyrs, the 117 martyrs of Vietnam immediately come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think again and again also of Edith Stein, of Maximilian Kolbe that I was talking about a little while ago, of again, these other martyrs of China. I mean, it's the significance of them in our lives today is something that I think John Paul II understood very profoundly. He anticipated, I think, so many of the challenges that we're facing now, but also that we're going to be facing. And in exactly the same way that the Christians in the 3rd century in the early 4th century facing persecutions were able to look back and appreciate the models of holiness that were provided by the martyrs that had gone just before, I think we can look today at some of the martyrs of the 20th century, of the last few centuries, as role models as we proceed now into sort of the great unknown of the 21st century that I fear, and that many experts fear, is going to be bringing even greater martyrdom for Christians around the world, as there is this kind of contraction of freedom in so many different places, both politically and also in the area of religion. So for me, those images of the saints who were martyred remain almost a haunting quality about the book.
Well, his selections are very thought-filled, or prayer-filled, I suppose you could say, as, again, the great theology lesson for us all in the lives of those selections.
Yeah. But the one thing, too, that we have to remember is that the process of beatification and then bringing it to completion in the process of canonization is contingent on miracles. So in a way, it's not, as some people like to say, the Holy Father decides who he's going to beatify or canonize, that mm-hmm. some people get the fast track. Well, it doesn't really work that way, and that goes back to your earlier question about the process of canonization. In order for a miracle to be approved, and I know because I've had a chance to study this very closely, you have a theological commission, you have a medical commission, and their task is to examine the scientific details that are involved in a supposed, presumed miracle. And their duty is a very intense one. And for them, the task is of determining that this is something truly remarkable, something that cannot be explained. And it's a sign, then, that this isn't something that's man-made, that as we move toward this beatification, as we move then and also for a second miracle to canonization, we can say theologically that it is extraordinary in a kind of religious context. It's a sign from God, and that it clearly was some form of a clear intervention. It has to involve something that exists independently of faith, though. Mm-hmm. So in other words, in contrast to sort of the natural processes, miracles, as I think St. Thomas Aquinas observed, are rightly to be termed miracles which are wrought by divine power apart from the order, as he put it, that's observed in nature. But it's also something that science itself, because it can't explain it, it's a wonder. Mm-hmm. It bears recognizable signs of God's intervention. And to then have a medical commission, the doctors involved, willing to testify to the fact that there is no scientific explanation for how this happened. How striking is that? That mm-hmm. in some cases, I believe that Chiara Badano's doctor, for example, was an atheist. How striking is that, that miracles happen all around us in these cases, but the world sometimes doesn't see them. We don't see them sometimes. But in order for a saint to be beatified, in order for a saint to be canonized, the miracle has to be certified, and that can take a long time, as I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened. Something happened, and it goes back to that studying of the saints, because not only are their lives then remarkable in their own right, not only are they remarkable for who they touched, but you have that sort of seal of approval, that final affirmation of their lives with a miracle, something that we can't explain, this act of the inexplicable in a reason-obsessed world, in a world that sort of hangs everything on trying to be rational, that hangs everything on scientific proof, that everything has to be and can be explained. Well, they can't be. So we're looking at this a kind of, it's more than just a process of canonization. It's a faith journey that begins, as I said, in a town, in a village, with the life of a person, and ends with this magnificent ceremony in St. Peter's Square or wherever else the beatification is, that brings tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands of people from around the world to celebrate the fact. And that crowning moment of it is a miracle born of love in which God intervenes and we can see it for what it is. And I would sort of conclude that by saying it has that Eucharistic aspect to it in the way that the Eucharist is a reality. But like with miracles, do we have the faith, do we have the intelligence, do we have the love to see it when it's standing right in front of us?
In this skeptical world, in today's very analytical, show me, give me proof I want to see. Mm-hmm. The lives of those saints who have been recently beatified have undergone that scrutiny. You could make those statements, whether it's Saint Jude or even a Saint Francis that lived so long ago, there is almost a mystery about them, and we just kind of, in some cases, some may even claim a superstition about them as Saint Anthony. But yet, when you look at the beatification process of a Jean Jagon or a Saint Damien, there is that type of scrutiny that miracle did in fact occur. So that attests to the power of God.
Yeah, precisely. And yet we're not doing that to impress the skeptics. Mm-hmm. We're doing it because we have an obligation in faith and also in charity to examine the lives of the saints as closely as possible, as intensely as possible, precisely because we take them so seriously. We take their lives so seriously. We take the faith so seriously. And we take the claims of the miraculous so seriously. Catholics especially are dismissed for being a superstitious lot. And yet, we exercise far greater care in the study of the lives of the saints than virtually any other walk of life for any other kind of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Because we believe that the saints are so important to us, because the saints are another means of reaching, of going to Christ. So if you actually believe that, you have to take things very seriously. You have to allow them to take their time. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a major element in why the process of canonization is and ought to be so complicated. And it's one of the things, too, that so many people don't understand about some of the processes involved with the sex abuse crisis, mm-hmm. that the laws of the church are deliberately complicated, maddeningly so to some people. But it's born out of respect, it's born out of concern, but it's born out of the need to make sure that what we do is right and proper, and that we do not err in our judgments, by which I mean the church is not going to proclaim someone a saint hastily or out of pressure or out of simply some great popular movement without that due consideration of law, of theology, and in the case of the miracles that are under examination, of science itself.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, as someone who really looks in the action in the church in the world today, you are someone who can maybe help us in the United States to see where we are going. And do we have those types of models today? I mean, do we have, yes, we have the great Catherine Drexel as a model religious, or Fulton Sheen. Mm-hmm. Do we have the Frassatis? Do we have the John Abrahamalas? Are we a people as laity in the church in America today capable of that kind of sanctity?
Yeah. And it's another great question, because we were talking a little while ago about this whole problem of cynicism, of almost two generations now that are raised with this idea that you don't really want to believe in anything wholeheartedly, because you'll probably be disappointed, and you don't want to give your life to something bigger than you are, because deep down there, to a lot of people today, there isn't a whole lot bigger than we are. Mm-hmm. I mean, this whole concept of we make our universe, we are sort of the center of our universe, refusing to commit to anything, and with this inability to commit in a way sort of has bled down to marriage. It has you can find it in almost every aspect of politics, of the most basic relationships that we have. And yet, as we look throughout the whole history of the church, if we look through human history, every generation is always firmly convinced that it's as bad as it can get. It can't get it possibly any worse.
Mm-hmm.
That the young people who are coming up are going to ruin the world. And I don't mean that flippantly. I mean, there's always this sense that things were always better in the past.
Mm-hmm.
From a Catholic standpoint, the history of the church tells us something that can be of enormous comfort. And that is if we trust in the Holy Spirit, and heaven knows we have throughout the history of the church an enormous amount of reason to do so,
mm-hmm.
we have that confidence that in every generation there will be those saints, that under the most unlikely circumstances, in the most unexpected ways, the saints emerge. There are women, there are men who respond to the call of the Holy Spirit, who accept the grace, who perfect the virtues, who make of their lives that kind of offering to Christ that can transform the world.
Mm-hmm.
Chiara Badano, Gianna are just two examples. But there are also the thousands, hundreds of thousands of young people out there right now who are striving to lead their lives in holiness, who have given themselves to Christ, and who we may not know about them now, and there's a good possibility we may never know about them, but they are having an impact on culture, they're having an impact on the church, and they're bringing souls to God. So I am immensely confident that the saints are always there when we need them, because they are the instruments of helping to bring Christ into the world.
Any final thoughts, Dr. Bunsen?
Well, as we celebrate All Saints Day, I always suggest to people that if you are not sure where to start, go with a book like John Paul II's Book of Saints, or go with the Saints Encyclopedia, or just search online. Look for your if you happen to be named after a saint, or you have the name of a saint, start looking around. Start studying their lives. At first, you may not find a saint that really appeals to you, but just keep reading the different lives. The internet is a great place for that now. Look for patron saints. Look for saints that might have some connection to your walk of life or what you do. And I urge that because inevitably, in the same way that you never know when you're going to find a friend or under what circumstances you'll discover a friend, you will find saints who become your friends, saints who are fascinating to you, saints who touch something in you, and saints who, in a way probably you would never have anticipated, somehow have a connection to your life that would never have occurred to you. And you'll develop in that a relationship, a friendship that will probably last for the rest of your life. And in that friendship, again, in that communion of saints, you'll have your life changed in ways, again, that you simply could not have imagined when you started that little quest of just looking up names of saints because they sound cool, or a name of saint who happens to be the patron of something that is part of your life. The surprising aspect of it is always one of the most fun parts of studying the lives of saints. And trust me when I say that with just 10,000 saints in the names in the list of the Roman Martyrology, you'll find more than enough to hold your interest, but you'll also find more than enough to change your life.
Well, we're all saints in the making, aren't we?
Well, we hope so.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us have farther to go than others, though.
Yeah, I can attest to that, being in the back of the line. But, yeah, with you to help lead the way, we really...
Well, but at least we're in the line.
Yeah, praise God. As the saints go marching in, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, thank you so much.
Well, take care and God bless. It's a privilege, as always, to be with you, Chris.
We've been going inside the pages of John Paul II's Book of Saints with Dr. Matthew Bunsen. Dr. Bunsen's work can be found at osv.com. the website for Our Sunday Visitor, as well as at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this discussion, along with many others, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.